trialing a new kind of scheme of like dealing with juror bias, but also looking at them just invoking rape myths in all defense statements as well on this woman.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, this is a problem that's been first recognized, well, it's been recognized for a long time, actually. There's a great book by Lees that goes back to, I believe, the early 90s, where they were first doing these kind of court observations and, yeah, lots of studies, including by Olivia Smith, who's one of the criminologists based here at Loughborough Uni, who sat in, I think, in one court building for around 18 months and sat in basically every rape case, and found examples of prosecution barristers, prosecution lawyers, challenging rape myths that were invoked by defence. Defence were, as you've mentioned, invoking these rape myths to try and discredit and raise questions around the veracity of the complainant's testimony. And the judge was doing very little in terms of intervening of rape myth usage. So she found clear evidence of this. Interestingly, showing, is this about barristers' their own beliefs, or is it about a trial tactic that they will invoke to win the case? So just by pure coincidence, in some of the other the later trials she watched, the prosecution lawyer that was doing a great job of challenging is now acting as defense lawyer and invoking rape myths, and the defense lawyer who was invoking is now working as the prosecution and challenging. So clearly it's this toolbox of things that barristers and lawyers pick up in order to win the case. I very recently, in the past couple of weeks, had a chat with a defence barrister, predominantly a defence barrister from the north of England, who is a fantastic defence barrister, a high rate of success, and said, what do you think about this idea? Should these things be off the table? Should rape myths not be something that barristers and lawyers can use? Like, surely if you're a good enough barrister, you don't need to invoke these myths and stereotypes to win the case. And yeah, I have to say, my understanding is it's widely perceived that these are, it's okay to, this is just a fair way of challenging the evidence. And if they're not true, then the jurors, they receive myths and stereotypes directions from the judge. They're told not to, jurors are told not to invoke them themselves and to not bring these things into play. So, if they're following the directions, they won't listen to this stuff anyway. But yeah, I have to say, from doing analysis of deliberations across a number of studies, and my colleagues, Dr. Siobhan Weir, who's a lawyer at Lancaster Law School, and Maddie Miller, who's a psych and law, she's our research associate on this huge Economic Social Research Council project we've got, where we're looking at jury decision making and deliberations in male-on-male rape cases and female-on-male rape cases, so where it's a woman alleged to have perpetrated a sexual offence against a man. And what barristers, that when barristers invoke rape myths, the jurors pick those up and they make use of them. So they are shaping narratives and trial outcomes on the basis of these things. So, yeah, we know that jurors, and my prior work in female complainant cases has already found this. We know that jurors, of course, why would they not? They're drawn from society where these myths are prevalent, and therefore when they go and serve as jurors, they bring a lot of these myths and stereotypes with them. They go into the cases believing some of those examples of rape myths we've already discussed. And so when these issues come up during trial, complainants, or something we haven't mentioned is demeanor of complainant. A female rape complainant, if she cries, it's too much. If she doesn't cry at all, it's not enough. Like, you basically can't win as a rape complainant because we have all of these deep-rooted myths and stereotypes, these assumptions about what really happens and how a real victim would behave. And for the most part, studies so far that I've been involved with, where the judge directs jurors not to believe these things, not to introduce myths and stereotypes, it appears like that's largely ineffective. Those directions don't appear to be listened to, or at least if there's challenges, jurors invoke rape myth and another juror says, well, hold on, we were told not to do that. Eventually, the jurors challenging the rape myth tend to give up because they tend to be in the minority. Most of the jurors believe these stereotypes. And where there's ambiguity in cases because there's a lack of strong physical evidence, we know from psychological theory, so there's a theory called the story model by Pennington and Hastie back in 1992, jurors fill in the blanks where there's an evidential gap with their own attitudes and beliefs. And rape cases, at least 90% of them that are acquaintance rape cases, they have huge gaping holes because it's one person's word against another. So without that strong physical evidence, what do jurors do? They introduce their own assumptions. And in rape cases where these beliefs are widely endemic throughout society, what they introduce are rate myths, and that's part of the problem. It's so difficult to try and, you know, we would need really strong evidence in order that jurors don't introduce those sort of stereotypes, and 90% of rape cases simply don't have that strong evidence. So there is an evidential problem, but there is an attitudinal problem too. And that's, I guess, why these cases are, that's one of the reasons I look at these cases. There's this dual impact. You know, there's evidential difficulties because it's a he said, she said, or a he said, he said. And so it is one person's word against another. DNA tells us only that the act happened, not whether it happened with consent. Sexual interactions tend to take place in private between two individuals. So, you know, independent witnesses, CCTV, all that usual stuff that we have that solves so many other cases, it's simply not available in most rape cases. And then on top of that, unlike, you know, with the exception of maybe domestic violence, where even domestic violence, I think the attitudes are changing such that, you know, we don't question as much now, why didn't she just leave? We understand the complexities. But in rape cases, those myths and stereotypes continue to exist. We think that women are walking around looking to falsely allege rape against men, and that simply isn't the case. So those two things come together and compound and have this huge impact whereby we simply just don't believe rape complainants, and that's why they struggle to get access to justice.
Yeah, I think back as well to, I think, I can't remember which paper it was I was reading that you were part of, about how jurors have a habit of, well, I think everyone has a habit of, in this like day-to-day lives, that they put themselves in the in the same shoes, and they'd be like, but what would I would have done? But the difference is, it's not, you're not the one that had that experience, so you can't go off of the base of what would you have done. And it comes back to this, this idea of juror education and things, because you're told when you go in to be on a jury from the judge that you need to be completely impartial, no prejudice, no bias. You listen to just the evidence and that's all you go off of. But that's never going to be the case, because in just everyday life, we're so, I socialize, but to just put yourself in the shoes of a person, what would I have done in that situation, and this, that, the other, that you ultimately put bias into it that way. In which
that's a really interesting point you made there. So there's been some great work exactly that kind of corroborates your point there, that suggests that, you know, so we even see differences between men and women in terms of the sort of myths, rape myths that they believe. So women tend to believe, this is a generalization, but researchers back this up, you know, theoretically speaking, and some studies corroborate this, women tend to be more, the myths that women endorse tend to be those that blame the victim. So that is saying things like, she shouldn't have gone down that dark alley on her own, she shouldn't have been wearing that skirt, shouldn't have got herself in such a state. So women say, believe those things about other women. And what we think is happening there from a psychological point of view is there's almost this like protective defense mechanism going on, where we say to ourselves as women, you say to yourselves as women, that if I don't do those things, then I won't be a victim of rape. So exactly your point there about making, we make assumptions about what we would and would not do. But the truth is, you know, and there's also studies that say most women will say things like, I would fight, I would scream, I would. And then, you know, but when your partner is the person raping you, the person you love and care about, you're completely off, you caught completely off guard, you're shocked, you're upset, you can't believe it's happening, and women freeze. And before that, you know, there's lots of studies, or at least some studies, that show women will say, before I was raped, I thought I would be one of those women that kick, scream and fight, and that's just not what I did. I was so shocked and terrified, I froze, I did nothing. And so that's part of the problem too, right? Like you, exactly like you said, we transpose what we hope we would do, what we believe we would do, and from a protective point of view, you know, we say we wouldn't put ourselves in that situation, so it therefore means that we judge complainants more harshly. Although I have to say, for sure, male jurors are much less likely to believe rape complainants than female jurors. You definitely, and across my studies and other studies, you definitely see a huge gender difference there, where female jurors are much more likely to convict and believe rape complainants, whereas male jurors tend to return not guilty verdicts and tend to be much more likely to rate the complainant's evidence as low in believability.
I would like to say I'm surprised that there's a gender difference, but I'm really not. In the case of a lot of what I've learned over here with other people that I've spoken to and gender-based violence, that it's clear there's just a very clear gender divide when it comes to who believes what and who, who believes what. So looking at, you've just said there's a gender divide in who believes certain rape myths and believing the complainant and things like that, what do you think are the most significant biases that jurors are bringing into rape and sexual assault cases? And this is probably going to be a split of different genders.
Yeah, I mean, like I say, generally speaking, female jurors believe rape complainants more so. And that's not just female rape complainants, that's male rape complainants too. There's something interesting going on there around the sexuality and the gender of the rape complainant. So this study that's led by Lancaster Law School that I'm part of, that Siobhan Ware and Maddie Miller are part of too, what we've been finding there is some interesting stuff that kind of deviates slightly. It's early days with findings, but it deviates slightly from what I'm finding in female complainant rape cases, which is we just simply don't believe, as a general rule, men in particular, male jurors in particular, but as a general rule, jurors don't believe female rape complainants. Now, we definitely see some of that with male rape complainants too. However, we're seeing some interesting stuff come out where jurors are more likely to convict in cases when it's a man making an allegation. And, you know, they are saying things like, is he secretly gay if he's making an allegation against another man? So we see that sort of stuff come out. And when the alleged perpetrator, when a man's making a rape allegation or a sexual assault allegation against a woman, they're saying things like, a real man would be able to fight back. So there's definitely some prominent myths that relate to gender. But overall, what we're seeing is jurors saying, why would he lie? Why would he make this up? So we don't say that for female rape complainants, because we've got a whole host of myths and stereotypes, many of which we've already discussed, that we wrongly believe are women's motivations, you know, what they're perceived to gain out of making an allegation of rape when it's false. We don't often see that transposing over to male rape complainants. We think that men have more to lose than to gain by making a rape allegation, and by virtue, jurors are therefore more willing to convict, generally speaking. Are they more willing to believe, whether we're more willing to convict is something else, they're more willing to believe a male rape complainant, even if they say, okay, I'm still going to say not guilty because the evidence isn't there to get me to that really difficult threshold of being sure, being beyond reasonable doubt, but they do believe the male rape complainants because they think they have no reason to lie. Simply, when it's a female rape complainant, most of the jurors in the studies that I've been part of, they simply just do not believe the rape complainant. They don't believe women when they make allegations of rape. There's a whole host of reasons around, yeah, those things we said around revenge, being caught cheating, financial gain if it's a high-profile celebrity. You know, I'm often shocked by cases, and you mentioned this high-profile one going on in Canada at the moment. High-profile individuals, celebrities, especially, you know, when someone makes a rape allegation, and when people make rape allegations that are very specific and those individuals have never met each other, that's called independent corroboration, and it becomes almost a form of evidence in and of itself. But rather than recognizing that, what we often see happen in society and in the media is say, well, they've got something, you know, financial gain, they're just clout chasing, and that's why they're making these allegations. I can tell you for sure, and lots of listeners will know this, most rape complainants, and women in particular, have way more to lose than they do to gain. When you make an allegation of rape, your character is assassinated, you're told you're lying. Studies, including one I was part of, women, the ultimate conclusion was women felt the police investigation and question of them was worse than the rape itself. And so women are not walking around making, you know, and also statistically, you're not likely to get a conviction. And if you're not likely to get a conviction, what is this huge pot of money you're going to get access to? It simply does not happen in the majority of cases. And so, yeah, that's the major thing from my perspective. I'm moving slightly, now I'm drifting from your question and more in terms of what can people learn and take away from this. And that is recognizing that women don't have stuff to gain by making a rape allegation. Their whole life gets turned upside down. And at the end of it, they have a 3% chance of getting a guilty verdict. So statistically speaking, the odds are against them in every which way. And so these are the real prominent myths that are difficult to challenge and that mean that, yeah, they're the barrier to victims getting access to justice. So this is also the complexity you mentioned about specific myths. These things are so deep-rooted and multifaceted that, you know, I once had a senior police officer from the Met, a very senior cop from the Met, who was part of a rape investigation team, Scotland Yard's National Rape Working Group, who said, okay, if, you know, if there's a long list of rape myths and you provide those tools, we can educate police and the public and, you know, kids at school about those, and then we'll get rid of this issue. it doesn't really work like that. I mean, that's a great step in the right direction, but these things are so complicated. There are so many rape myths, and they overlap, and they change, you know, change the age of the victim, change the gender of the victim, and they're no longer a myth, or they are a myth. So they're so multifaceted that it's difficult to try and educate people about the realities of them, and therefore we have a whole host of myths that continue to be a problem.
There's one thing I've noticed about just the gender-based violence sector is everything is overlapping and everything is multi-layered, and so many people I've spoken to have used the like analogy of it's like an onion and you just have to keep peeling away because there's just so many layers to it all. And you mentioned about how women will not really will have far more to lose than they would to gain in making allegations. And one thing that I've found very interesting is one of the interviews I've done about forensic evidence collection over here in rape and sexual assault cases, because looking when I've been like looking at the whole criminal justice system of the whole invasive nature of it for sexual assault and rape survivors, what would you do to alter the process to make it more trauma-informed? Because the common theme that I am seeing when I've read your research papers, when I've spoken to people, is that the system is just a huge risk in re-traumatizing people, and that deters them from reporting it straight off the bat.
Yeah, I mean, that is a very, that is the question, isn't it? That's a, and it's a difficult one, because the consequences of, I mean, the, it's a, I always struggle with this, because the reality is if you report an allegation of sexual violence, you probably are going to come out worse than if you didn't. And so I don't want to discourage victims of sexual violence from reporting, but the truth is the process is going to be very tough and challenging, and the odds of getting a guilty verdict at the end of it are very slim. So I do, you know, lots of victim survivors will disclose to me because of the work I do, and they'll say, what do you think, should I report, this is what happened. And I say, you have to think about the reasons for reporting. Like, if you are happy and ready for the challenge ahead, sadly it's a challenge and it's all sorts of hurdles and difficulties coming your way, but if you're ready, if you're happy to go through this process and know that there is quite a high likelihood that you won't get access to justice, but that nonetheless this person who's sexually assaulted or raped you will be hauled in, they'll be questioned, there'll be a question mark over their name, and hopefully you'll get justice, but the chances are slim. If you're okay and happy to do that, then go for it. But the sad reality is for most victim survivors, exactly like you said, Rebecca, they are going to end up being traumatized by the process. So you need a strong group of people who support you around you. Hopefully you've got friends and family. You know what's ahead of you. That's the key thing, being aware of what's to come and some of the challenges you're going to face. But the truth is, I mean, there's lots of things we know we could do and should do. There's victim services that support victim survivors nowadays. There's some countries and jurisdictions have specialist rape courts where everybody involved is well aware of the complexities. We have much improved, it's not perfect and still a very long way to go and lots of variability between police officers, but we have much better, more specialist police investigators that will take you through this process. In a you know, once upon a time being interviewed by the police, this footage from the 70s and 80s, which is grim to watch, you've probably seen some of it. Prosecutors, you know, more scrutiny, being open about the process, being trauma informed and aware. But we've got such a long way to go, and there's even where you see areas of great practice. I recently gave a talk at a conference and I was talking about digital strip searches, so where rape complainants, their phone gets taken sometimes up for two years. Their phone, you know, we all live on our phones now. Their phone has been taken up to 2 years, no replacements provided. Every message they've ever sent on a dating app is being scrutinized like that has any relevance to somebody who sexually assaulted them. And often the same isn't the case, you know, that the same treatment isn't happening to the person who's been accused. They'd like to get the phone back a lot quicker than that. And a police officer said to me, well, I'm part of a rape detective team, we're looking specifically at rape investigations, and we get all of our phones back to our complainants within 2 weeks. And I said, that's fantastic, and that's a great area of good practice, and you're reducing, you know, that's about being trauma informed to some extent, but that's not the national picture and that's not the international picture. So yeah, there's lots of things we can be doing and should be doing. The truth is, we're all, like you said, this onion with lots of layers, we're so far away from doing those things at the minute that the likelihood is you're going to have a tough experience. Claire McGlynn, I don't know if you've come across Professor Claire McGlynn at Durham University. She talks about this concept of telescopic justice, and it kind of looks at different alternatives to the criminal justice route and option, especially within sexual offence cases. And you might have heard that lots of people now are talking about a criminal legal system instead of a criminal justice system, because can something by definition have justice in the name when for 97% of rape victims, they're not going to get access to justice? So it's a legal process. And this telescopic justice looks at alternatives, you know, controversial, some of them. For example, some people are looking at restorative justice for rape cases, but, you know, where the accused, the offender, takes responsibility and there's some reprimation, you know, they're trying to reduce the impact and the harm caused. But it's ultimately down to individual victim survivors what they want to do. And I think that is the key trauma-informed approach here. It's about asking victim survivors, what do you want here? What is a good outcome for you, set against this backdrop of criminal justice outcomes being very unlikely?
Mm. Yeah, because I found it interesting, and I don't think I really fully comprehended how invasive just the whole process is, from reporting it right off the bat and then to the jury trial side of things. Because I knew kind of how the complainant's character is instantly stripped apart in court. I mean, I experienced that when I was part of a jury, of looking at how they broke apart the two complainants' characters and stripped away all of it. But I found it interesting when I came over here and I started talking to different people about kind of how clinical the whole process is. And even when I spoke to Leonie, and she said the whole court atmosphere and system is so clinical as well when you go into there. But like going before that, the kind of, I would say, the people feeling the need that they need to be getting that forensic evidence, because that's a driving force of, like, I guess, towards a guilty verdict, because you have that evidence that at least the act did happen, and then you are kind of like halfway, I would say, there. But how invasive that process is and how in-depth it is to be getting that evidence. And if you have to do that pretty much as soon as the act has taken place, that you're still going to try and process what's just happened, to then have to go through that, and you're almost re-traumatizing yourself within like 24 hours of such a traumatic event happening, that I find it interesting what solutions are coming out to change kind of the whole system. Because obviously you focus quite heavily in on the trials and the juries and the barristers, when you look at the whole big picture, and it's like, we could fix that, but then you're going to need to move to another section and another section and another section. There is this whole huge heap, like it's like a knotted ball of like wool, and you're like pulling at one end, but you need to be pulling at all the ends to like unravel this huge problem. And I think as well, like it contributes as well to why there's such a hidden figure of crime in that reporting, because that is, people now all know that that's the process they're going to have to go through, that you instantly get deterred from reporting it, being like, I'd rather just focus on like healing myself from the event and moving on than having to heal myself and then go through it all again, have it all broken apart, especially with the backlog of cases. You don't know how many years you're going to be waiting.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree with you. It is, the whole process end to end is failing. And, you know, there are lots of people putting lots of effort and dedicating their whole careers to improving things, but the backlog, the lack of investment in the right areas, and the systemic failings, as well as the volume. You know, we have seen an increase in reporting after, you might have heard of this concept of the Savile effect. So after the high profile case of Jimmy Savile, the police experienced a large number of victim survivors, especially historic cases, where they were more willing to come forward and report what happened to them. And that's obviously a good thing. We see the numbers increasing for that reason. And so the system is trying or attempting to process those numbers and work through them. But there are also some gaming of the system, some gaming of the statistics to try and, you know, rather than dealing and investing properly in the appropriate criminal justice responses, there's often like how do we get rid of some of these cases because the caseload is too high? Or the caseload means, like you said already, the backlog is just stacking up higher and higher, and then victims' experiences is getting worse and worse. You know, the notion that you report something and it takes 5 years to get to trial, which is not a rarity in the UK, for a rape case is simply, it's just not good enough. And if that's the experience, like, clearly there is systemic failings that need to be dealt with. If it's taken 4 or 5 years for your rape case to get to trial, if at all, you know, and most of them will not even get there. So, yeah, the whole, in an ideal world, we'd rip it down and start again. But, you know, we're not in an ideal world. And so it's about looking. Thankfully, we're very lucky in the UK context that there's lots of academics and researchers specializing and working on these issues. I know in the context in Canada is, you know, you're also a much bigger geographical space. There are some passionate people working very hard, but it's also, there's not perhaps as many. And so you can draw on the UK and other research evidence from here. And there's obviously similarities in the justice models, but the first hand on the ground Canadian specific research is not always there, or it's certainly not as well established. And so that's an additional challenge that's facing Canada, I think, that, you know, the evidence, we can draw on evidence from Australia or from the UK or from the US, but does it directly transpose? And I think that's part of the issue. You know, the stuff around barristers and their use of rape myths in particular, I'm not aware of any specific studies from a Canadian context. Apologies if someone out there has done one and I've not seen it. But, you know, whilst we have lots of court observation studies in the UK looking at how barristers are using rape myths and how they are, you know, this gently approach now where we say, of course, it's, you'll often see them saying, of course, it's very normal that lots of rape complainants don't report straight away. But in this case, members of the jury, you must ask yourself, why did it take this complainant 3 years to make their report to the authorities? You heard evidence from them today that they ultimately reported it because they were worried he would do this to someone else. Does that match the idea that it took them 3 years? If they didn't want him to do it to someone else, they would have reported straight away. So they invoke the myth, or they challenge the myth, and then they distance the facts of the case from it. And so we have this research in the UK, but my understanding is there is a deficit of research in a Canadian context that means strong evidence that can be used to lobby change, you know, it's more difficult, isn't it?
The Sexual Violence Support and Prevention Office, SVSPO, offers confidential support, advice, and referrals to SFU and FIC community members, including students, staff, and faculty who have been impacted by sexual violence and misconduct. The SVSPO is a welcoming place where you can access support without judgment or assumptions. We work from a survivor-centered perspective, using an empowerment and trauma-informed approach that considers individual situations and perspectives. Please reach out. Services are located at the Diamond Alumni Center, room 014 on the lower level. Please reach out by email at sv-support@sfu.ca. That was sv-support@sfu.ca.
I'm DJ Coco.
And I'm DJ Star.
Come join us for Slumber Party, Tuesdays at 6 p.m.
You'll hear female artists, oversharing, and research on health, psychology, and identity.
Hope to see you there.
And welcome back to Intravenous here on CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby Campus and Community Radio from Simon Fraser University, where we are now just coming up to the end of the hour. I want to thank you all for tuning in. I'd also like to thank again Dr. Dominic Wilmot for being able to take part in that conversation with me. That is only part one. There will be a part two airing next Wednesday, so be sure to tune back in for Intravenous then. But I was very thankful to have that conversation. Also, it's very difficult to organize with the obvious time difference, but I'm very glad it managed to happen. I think it's a very important topic that should be talked about despite the heavy, I guess, weight of the subject, and that it's not something a lot of people will want to speak about. I think it's important it gets its, I guess, recognition on how severe the topic is. So yeah, I hope everyone has a good rest of their day and a good rest of their week. And be sure to stay tuned as we have Democracy Now coming up from 11 to 12. And yeah, I would like to say keep tuning in for the rest of the miniseries. We're about halfway through now. I have part two of Dr. Dominic Wilmot's discussion, and I also have my discussion with Chloe, Jacqueline, and Patty coming up the week after, which was very interesting. So, yeah, thank you all for tuning in.
You are listening to CJSF